I wanted to start off with just some general overview questions. Yeah. And first of all, what are the challenges in the whole issue of canonicity today? What are the biggest challenges that the church faces?
I think that every Christian at their core has curiosity questions about the canon. I think they recognize what we all recognize, which is that the Bible is a distinctive kind of book because it's really made up of a number of smaller books, of course, all written by different authors or for many different authors. And so I think people know that, well, this is one book where God is the ultimate author, but I've got all these smaller books, and that raises questions about the right books. And so I think there's an intuitive question that people have from the outset just by observing what unique kind of book the Bible is. And then when you have that starting point for most believers who already wonder about that question, then there's these external factors that just exacerbate it and make it worse. And I'll just mention a few of the factors that I think are sort of feeding the obsession with canon in our culture today. One, I think obviously, particularly in the 20th century, is the discovery of new apocryphal materials that we didn't know about. It was really the early 20th century, of course, with the Nag Hammadi discovery in particular, where there's this explosion of apocryphal literature on the scene. When I say apocryphal literature, I just mean on the New Testament side. Obviously, things like the Gospel of Thomas, but a variety of other Gospels and other writings that we came to know, and that raises questions about whether we have the right books. Again, what about these books, people wonder. The continual discussion of lost Gospels and lost versions of Christianity, I think, exacerbate the question. Yeah, a second reason that I think people continue to be interested in the question of canon in our culture today is a renewed interest in a scholar by the name of Walter Bauer. Bauer wrote a very now famous book, at least, in 1934 called Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity. And that book argued that early Christianity was wildly diverse, that there are all these different factions fighting for what was the true version of Christianity, each different group claiming to be the original Christianity, to be the true Christianity. And all those different factions had their own books. Bauer argues in his writings that, well, the books you have are just the books of the theological winners. They're no special, more special than any other books out there. If another group had won, say the Gnostics had won, you'd be reading the Gospel of Philip or the Gospel of Truth or what have you, and it wouldn't be at all the same collection of books. And so Bauer's thesis has been rejuvenated really through the works of scholars like Bart Ehrman and others who now want to sort of tout his work afresh. That's raising canonical questions yet again. And then the third area, I think, that's renewing interest in canon is this question of the authorship of the books of the New Testament. Were they really written by the people that they're assigned to? Did Paul really write all these letters? Were there forgeries in there? Are these works pseudonymous? Scholars are always dripping away at that theme, suggesting that the authors of the books are not who we think they are. And that raises canon questions, because if Peter didn't write 2 Peter, then you raises the question of whether Peter should be, or 2 Peter should be in the New Testament. Maybe we should take it out. And those kinds of questions, all three really working together, have made canon really one of those issues that we need to always be addressing as evangelical Christians.
It's kind of hard to underestimate the impact of Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code and his view on the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah.
What would you say to that?
Yeah, well, ever since Dan Brown's book on the Da Vinci Code came out, canon questions have been talked about even more, because now you have a popular-level fictional book making claims that the canon was chosen at the Council of Nicaea or at some other council, and there was some vote about these books, and that Constantine was using his political pressure to keep certain books in and other books out. And people love those sorts of things. I mean, the popular culture loves conspiracy theories. They love the idea that things were done in a secret way and only now we know the truth, this sort of thing. The unfortunate reality, though, is that it doesn't really square with what we know about the historical evidence at all. Although it's a repeated sort of trope from Dan Brown and others that the Council of Nicaea was the place the canon was chosen, there's no real historical evidence that's the case at all. In fact, there's no real evidence that the New Testament canon was discussed at all at the Council of Nicaea. Nicaea was really designed to deal with how to articulate the divinity of Jesus and his relationship to the Father. It wasn't designed to articulate issues related to canon. So it's a wonderful way to come up with a conspiracy theory where Constantine picks these books. But when you look at the historical facts, Nicaea is not really a factor in determining which books got in and which books got out.
As we do kind of an overview on the issue of canon, you use the words exclusive, functional, and ontological.
Yeah.
Could you just give a broad stroke understanding of this?
Yeah. Well, whenever you talk with someone about the issue of canon, one of the things that quickly becomes evident is there's fairly widespread disagreement about what the word canon means. Or when you use the word canon, what concept are you referring to? This particularly becomes an issue in terms of the canon's date. So when someone says you can date the canon to such and such a date, well, you have to know what you're looking for that counts as canon in order for you to say you have it or don't have it. And so in my book, what I've done is I've tried to help sort of sift through that complexity by offering three different definitions of canon. One is called the exclusive definition. This is popular in modern scholarship today and has a level of legitimacy to it. And what they argue is that you don't really have a canon until you have a fixed, final, closed list of books to which nothing can be added or taken away. And until you get to that point in time, you can't say you have a canon. You can have scripture, a loose collection of authoritative writings, but you can't have a canon until you have that fixed, final, closed list. And so that's called an exclusive definition. On that definition, you really wouldn't have a canon until the 4th century. I argue also for what's called the functional definition of canon, a second definition, and this isn't unique to me. Other scholars have suggested this. Brevard Childs is a good example. And he argues that, look, well, you don't have to wait to have a fixed, final, full, closed list before you have a canon. Really, you have a canon when books are functioning like Scripture. In other words, if you have authoritative books that are functioning like scriptural books in the life of Christians, and they're using them like scriptural books, you functionally have a canon. The boundaries may not be solidified, fair enough. There may be some fuzziness on the edges, okay, but you still have a canon, and so we can use the term in a functional way. And then what I've suggested is actually a third definition, what I call the ontological definition. And what I argue for there is that the first two definitions are fine as far as they go, but they don't acknowledge that there's something about these books that's true of them, regardless of whether anything or any group ever receives them. In other words, we want to argue that canonicity is an attribute of a book that's distinctive from its reception. Otherwise, it comes dangerously close to suggesting that reception makes a book canonical. Wouldn't want to go down that path. We'd want to suggest that books are canonical when they're recognized as such, but if they're recognized as such, there has to be something about the books themselves that make them canonical. And so therefore, I argued for what's called an ontological definition, the idea that the books that are canon are the books that God gave his church to guide them as authoritative scripture. When you ask it that way, you're almost looking at canon through the lens of the way God would see it. And if you look at it that way, you really have a canon in the 1st century. God gave these books to his church in the 1st century, and we could say we have a canon then, even if it's not widely recognized. So those three definitions are all valid in their own way, and I think they all balance each other out.
And that brings up one of the most important distinctions in your writing, and that is the difference between a book becoming canonical and being recognized as canonical.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is a category mistake that is really, really critical to get. When people talk about the canon and its date and so forth, there is a sense that books were written for one purpose, but then later the church sort of hijacked these books and used them for another purpose, and they made them canon. They infused authority into them, or they declared them to be something that they were otherwise not. I find that, and I'm not the first one that finds that, highly problematic, both theologically and historically. We want to be very careful with that, because if we say that the church makes a book canonical, or that the books become canonical by virtue of a declaration from the church, that comes very close to suggesting that the real authority is not in the books at all, but really just in the church or the declaration or the activity that received them. And so I make a point in the book to make it clear that there's something inherent about these books that's true regardless of whether anyone recognizes them. And therefore, what you have in canon is not so much creating something that's not there or making something. Rather, it's recognizing what's already true. That's historically the Protestant conception of canon. The term recognized is the word that's often used. We recognize what's true rather than make something true that wasn't otherwise the case.
On a final note for this introduction, one of the most fascinating parts of your books that I found was the whole issue of how do you know something?
Yeah.
That comes up multiple times mm-hmm. in your writing, that all ultimate systems require faith.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about that? Because, again, yeah. if we set the bar so high, nothing's going to pass.
Yeah.
And we're never going to have any assurance
yes.
that canon's a canon.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, one of the things I really wanted to answer in my book, which I felt like not many canon books honestly dealt with, is the issue of epistemology. And what I mean by that is answering the question of how you know. Most canon books up to this point have been more of what I call data books. And so what they do is they just tell you historical data about when a book was received or what a church father thought about a book. And those are all important things to know. But the canon books I've been reading were never dealing with the question of, well, what grounds does a Christian have for thinking he could know this? Or what is the mechanism by which a Christian could know which books are from God and which books aren't? So one of the things I think you have to have if you're going to answer that question is really what I call a theology of canon. In other words, Did God give a mechanism by which a Christian or the church generally could know which books are from God? Is there some structure by which knowledge is acquired in this way? And I argued that, you know, and the whole point of the book was to argue that, yes, God has given a mechanism, if you will, a means by which you could recognize and know which books are from him. Now, as soon as you say that, though, you realize you can't have an answer to that question without actually using the very authority that you're trying to prove. And this gets into the inevitable circularity of the whole enterprise, is that everybody who tries to prove an ultimate authority is eventually going to have to use that ultimate authority and the method in which they prove it. Otherwise, it ceases to be ultimate. And so a large part of the book dealt with the way we philosophically think about how we acquire knowledge and making sure that we're not naive about the way we argue for canon. And that was an important aspect of what I was trying to accomplish.
I think a good example of the circular is to take any ultimate system of belief, materialism.
Yes.
Where you can't prove there isn't anything, but can you use that as a parallel?
Yeah, and one of the examples I use in the book, I think, that is helpful in this regard is, what if I wanted to prove the reliability of my sense perception? You know, I wanted to prove the reliability that when I see something, I'm seeing it accurately, or that my senses are accurately representing the world. How would I show such a thing? Well, I couldn't actually even show such a thing unless I actually use my sense perception in order to demonstrate the reliability of my sense perception. So if someone wanted to test their eyesight, they could lay out a chart on the wall and draw out 10 feet and say, well, I'm going to put this eye chart on the wall and make sure my eyes are working correctly, but I'm presuming my eyes are working correctly when I set up the test in the first place. And if someone says, well, you could have your buddy set it up, sure, but then I have to ask the question whether his eyesight's working, and I'm back where I was again. And so eventually, when it comes to ultimate authorities, or ultimate means of knowing things, you can't demonstrate them without actually using them. And there's nothing philosophically problematic about that. It's an inevitability when you're dealing with ultimate authorities.
So in other words, your ultimate goal in the book is not to prove.
Correct. People, when they deal with issues like biblical authority, in this case, the particular issue of do we have the right books, there's an inherent desire, I think, among evangelicals that I'm going to demonstrably, empirically prove that the canon is correct, that we have the right books. And I was very clear from the outset that I was not intending to do that. I have doubts about whether that's something that can be done to the skeptic anyway. And what I mean by that is not that I doubt that there's reasons to believe that the canon is right. I think there's tremendously good reasons to believe. But the idea that I can prove that to the skeptic without dealing with worldview issues, I think, is naive. And so I'm dealing with a different question. I'm not asking the question of how to prove the truth of the canon. I'm asking the question is, do we have grounds for thinking we can know which books are in the canon? And so the issue I wanted to deal with in the book was not so much demonstrating the truth of canon, but asking whether we can account for our belief in canon. In other words, to put it a different way, are Christians just blindly leaping in the dark when we say these 27 books are the right ones? Is it just a hope? Is it a guess? Is it like, well, we hope we're right? Is there any way we could even know that? That question is rarely asked. And what I wanted to deal with in the book is actually, I think God has given a structure for how we can know that. And if so, then actually Christians can account for our knowledge of canon. Even if the skeptic disagrees with us, what I've tried to show here is a separate question. Even if the skeptic says, I don't believe those are the right books, at least we can make an argument that Christianity has a basis for making the claim in the first place. And that's a very good place to start.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions.